All financial advice provided on this show is for entertainment and educational purposes only. The financial ideas and strategies discussed are only provided as a starting point for a conversation about money matters. With regard to your particular investments and financial strategies, consult your financial planner, CPA, or investment professional. All your financial decisions are yours and yours alone to make and subsequently are solely your responsibility. The information that is supplied through the context of the radio program and any repurposing of its content by the host or network is a combination and collection of solid financial investment understanding, opinion, and comments. This network, show, and its host are not liable for financial strategies, outcomes that you employ in any manner that result in any kind of loss. Shares of corporate sponsors may be the subject of buy or sell recommendations in Jay Taylor's newsletter in accordance with Jay's objective opinion.
Welcome to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. This hour will help investors fix issues and achieve personal gain. Now, here's your host, Jay Taylor.
Welcome to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I am your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm speaking to you here from New York City in Queens, the 19th day of May, 2020. I want to thank each of you for listening to this show and making it one of the more popular shows in the Voice America Business Channel. And I want to invite you to keep your questions and comments, whatever they may be, send them along to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com, questions, the number for taylor@gmail.com. And we do want to thank our sponsors, because without them, there would be no show. Today's sponsors are RN Resources, Great Bear Resources, Hannon Metals, Irving Resources, Novo Resources, and Sitka Gold Corp. Before I get to today's show, let me pass along a few thoughts of my own. Michael Oliver is not with us this week, but I'd like to pass along a thing or two that he had to say in his weekend missive to his paid subscribers regarding gold and silver. Michael said that gold is probably the most important market to be focused on now. Many implications, he suggested. And let me just quote a couple things that Michael said. First of all, he said, and I quote, "Gold has remained stout since the late summer 2018 lows, with teasing quick sell-offs that fool the majority. And this trend persisted whether U.S. stocks were up or down. And despite the dollar remaining quietly firm, MSA has warned those who are fearful of a weak stock market causing gold to trend down that they will be fooled by that false assumption. Similarly, with a constant fear of continued steady to firm dollar. Looking back, momentum registered two major breakouts," and you would need to see Michael's charts to be able to see with clarity what he's talking about. But then he said, "Nothing since that has altered that fact nor momentum's direction. We now offer one last buy trigger level. This one based on quarterly momentum. Trade up to 18, 19, and 50 cents this quarter, and you can consider that MSA's last gold buy trigger, that will be MSA's last gold buy trigger. That is 18, 19.50. And then Michael continued, he said, "We suspect any further gains by gold will be dramatic, sizable, and sudden, not a continuation of the arm wrestling yet persistent uptrend of the past 2 years." End of quote. Regarding silver, Michael has also, what he has to say should gladden the hearts of the silver bulls. In his May 3rd weekend report, Michael defined two monthly momentum breakout levels. Those trigger numbers were $15.20 and $15.55. The May 7th action engaged those buy triggers, and the launch for silver was ignited. And I quote Michael, he said, "Price has since also achieved a key level, namely breaking back above last month's high at $16.30. By clearing the $16.30 level, silver punched back above that resistance and, in Michael's view, is now rapidly heading back to the $19 level. But he doesn't think that set of prior highs, either side of 19, will halt the advance. Instead, annual momentum argues," Michael says, "that reaching there again will likely engage the final trigger for silver." Michael noted that a trade above $19.42 this month is a massive annual momentum structural breakout. Michael expects that this silver surge, especially if it tags that annual number soon, which he fully expects it will rapidly drive silver into the very upper 20s, and perhaps there it will want to pause, congest, before moving higher from that level. So regarding the gold shares versus gold, Michael's work also revealed that the shares are now getting the upper hand over gold bullion. Well, there isn't much to dislike if you're a gold or silver bull, from what Michael has to say, but that said, I would like to comment on a question from a listener to this show named John, who is an ex-scientist, and he admits to not being well-versed in things financial. But paraphrasing John, he is concerned that even if your gold shares rise dramatically, their price is denominated in dollars. So when you sell, what good does that do if you're going to own something that isn't worth very much and is declining in value dramatically? As the dollar is rapidly losing value. And that, I believe, will be the case given the trillions of dollars that is being printed and created out of thin air by the Federal Reserve and other central banks. But to that, I would answer John by saying you don't have to hold dollars. You can take the dollars from the sale of your gold stocks and buy gold, and you can do so in the form of an ETF like OUNZ, which, as Axel Merck pointed out last week when he was on the show, you can easily take delivery of gold that is backed by that, by your shares of OUNZ, if you wish to do so. And by the way, Axel Merck will be with us in the second half of today's show, and I might ask him to briefly comment on the process for taking delivery again, because I think it's a very important issue in this day when we can expect that the fiat currencies are going to lose value very rapidly. I would mention that, of course, when you sell your gold shares, you will have a tax event, unless, of course, you're holding them in your IRA. In that case, you won't need to face a tax event until you start taking your money out in your retirement. Another listener named Steve, who subscribes to my letter and to Chen's newsletter, asked if I would recommend a third newsletter writer that covers the gold mining sector. And I could do so, but it is important to know who to recommend. It's really impossible to know who to recommend unless I know a person's investment objectives. Any of the newsletter writers I work with at the Metals Investor Forum, like Eric Coffin, Gwen Preston, Joe Masmider, John Kaiser, Greg McCoach, Brian London, and of course Chen is there as well, they're all very good, but each have their own unique investment styles and focus. For example, some are more risk-averse than others, while some offer the 10-bagger type long shots that certainly inherently have more risk. But what I should actually do sometime, I believe, and I actually have had some of them on my show in the past, but perhaps have my colleagues from the Metals Investor Forum come on this show and explain their investment objectives and share that with you, because I think that would be valuable advice. It's important to subscribe to somebody whose perspective is similar to your own so that you're comfortable with their philosophy. Moving on to today's show, I've titled the show, Can You Prosper During This Gargantuan Economic Decline? Axel Merck returns, and Lynn Alden appears for the first time on this show. When gold was removed from the monetary system in 1971, it opened the floodgates of money creation by a legal, though I would posit immoral, counterfeiting operation headed by the Federal Reserve Bank and basically all, not basically, all other central banks around the world. They all create money out of nothing. Although, of course, the U.S. and the Federal Reserve, having the world's reserve currency, can do so more aggressively and more extensively than any other country in the world at this point in time, unless that changes, and that may be a topic that we'll broach this afternoon as well. In any event, the result of this massive money creation has been consistent currency destruction and credit bubbles that are blown up to the point where the laws of nature stops, such as in 2008, 2009, when the wheels fell off the credit expansion because the central bankers pushed things to the point where it breaks down. And then what we get then with a new creation, another cycle of money creation, is a massive transfer of wealth from the productive sector of the economy, the middle class that actually produces things that add value to our lives, to the people that control the monetary system, namely the Federal Reserve, the banks, and the government. So we go from the productive sector to the parasitic sector, and ultimately we're all the worse off for it. Well, even before the coronavirus pandemic wreaked havoc on global economies, we were in for another economic recession, bound to be bigger than that of 2008-2009, simply because the credit bubble that was blown by the Federal Reserve after 2008 was the biggest yet. So that when the bubble burst, when it was bound to burst, the losses in financial assets are certainly bound to be the biggest yet, even larger than the catastrophic declines of 2008-2009. So far, we haven't seen that, of course. The equity markets are holding up quite well. But with the sudden event of COVID-19, job losses are now more extreme than anything ever seen in America, including that of the Great Depression. But remember Ben Bernanke, who has always claimed that the Great Depression was caused simply because Fed chairmen at that time were not as smart as he is, didn't respond quickly enough, he says, that they didn't respond quickly enough and, in fact, started raising rates when they should have been lowering them. Well, Ben thinks he has all the answers, right? So he's exploded the balance sheet, the bank's balance sheet, the federal bank's balance sheet, and we have this massive bubble that is now breaking down again, you know, a little more than 10 years later, 12 years later, and it's breaking down again before COVID-19. And we'll get into the reasons I say that, and Lynn Alden will certainly help us understand that as well during the second segment of today's show. And of course, 2020 hindsight is wonderful. It allows you to point fingers at others and not focus on the best way to move forward. What Dr. Bernanke and all Federal Reserve economists fail to recognize is that the Fed is the manufacturer of these bubbles and is therefore responsible for the massive losses suffered by average people and smaller businesses to the benefit, at least to the redistribution of wealth towards Wall Street and their pernicious government bedfellows. As parasitic governments grow at the expense of the productive sector of our economy, when the Fed starts blowing the next bubble, that seems to be the cycle that we're still on. We shall see if it continues on once again as this bubble nears its end and finally comes to its conclusion, aided and abetted by COVID-19 for sure. Indeed, as we enter this section, this decline, there are many who believe, some who believe, that America is reaching its fourth turning in American history. The other fourth turnings in America's history so far, the Revolutionary War, the Civil War, and World War II. And so many are believing that what we are facing now with COVID-19 and the destruction of our monetary system is akin to and as significant as those other major turning points in American history. What we hope to accomplish on this show is to provide some help in turning these impending hard times into good times simply by alerting you to what is likely to lie ahead of us in the future. No one, of course, except God Almighty knows for sure what is lying ahead of us, and I would also suggest that he has everything under his control. But that, of course, is a spiritual element that everyone has to decide for themselves. In any event, when we come back from our first commercial break, Lynn Alden will join us to provide her insights into the economic forces behind the surface in an effort to try to help us prepare as best we can for the difficult times that most certainly seem to lie ahead. So don't go away. We'll be right back with Lynn Alden right after our first commercial break.
Novo Resources Corp. trades on the OTCQX under the symbol NSRPF and on the TSX Venture Exchange under the symbol NVO. Its flagship assets are located in the Pilbara region of Western Australia. Novo has recently partnered with Sumitomo Corporation of Japan to evaluate, advance, and develop the company's Australian gold projects. With over $40 million in cash and $60 million committed from Sumitomo, Novo is well on its way to establishing itself as one of the top junior explorers and developers in Australia.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really pleased to have with me for the first time Lynn Alden. Lynn's background lies in the intersection of engineering and finance. She holds a bachelor's degree in electrical engineering and a master's degree in engineering management with a focus on engineering economics and financial modeling. She oversees the finances and day-to-day operations of an engineering facility has been performing investment research for over 15 years in various public and private capacities. Her work has been editorially featured or cited on at Forbes, Business Insider, Market Watch, Times Money Magazine, The Daily Telegraph, The Street, CNBC, U.S. News and World Reports, Kiplinger, Huffington Post, and elsewhere. And she is also a regular contributor to Seeking Alpha, FedWeek, and Elliott Wave Trader. Lynn's logical thinking as an engineer rings through to her analysis of the driving forces behind markets and her work to explain what was driving the repo markets last September, and that is really what has alerted me to her excellent work. In fact, my friend Eric Coffin at the Metals Investor Forum first sent me an email telling me of Lynn's work, and which I have been following on a regular basis since then. And you can keep up with her thinking on a regular basis by following her on Twitter, which I do, and you can and most certainly should go to her website, lynnalden.com. That's Lynn, LynnAlden.com, where she provides research and strategy covering stocks, options, precious metals, international equities, and alternative investments with a specialization in asset allocation. And Lynn publishes a newsletter every 6 weeks. I'm looking at one that she just she put out March titled Crashing Down Through John Exter's Pyramid. And we've certainly talked about John Exter on this show in the past. And then in May, a letter that just came out this morning, hot off the press, titled First Liquidity, Then Solvency. Well, those are certainly topics of interest to me, and I'm sure with many listeners to this show. So let me suggest again that you go to Lynn Alden, LynnAlden.com, to sign up for her free newsletter. And Lynn also puts out research posts from time to time. They keep track of ongoing market dynamics. And one of those that she recently published was titled Quantitative Easing, MMT and Inflation Deflation. That is really what I want to talk to Lynn today about. So thank you so much for joining us today, Lynn. It's really great to have you with us.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
It's really good to have you. First time again to speak with you after I've read your work first. It's really a pleasure. Lynn, in that article that you wrote, that special article, Quantitative Easing, MMT and Inflation Deflation, you provided illustrations showing how our federal government traditionally funded itself. It would fund itself by way of borrowing from its citizens and then expanding to borrow from citizens of other countries. Can you contrast those traditional methods of financing with quantitative easing, which was put in play after the 2008 financial crisis?
Yeah, sure. So the article outlines four different models of government financing. And then the first one is the more traditional one, which is domestic government borrowing. So in addition to taxing from the population and spending it back into the economy. They also borrow from the citizens and the firms within the country as treasury securities, and then they use that as well to finance their government spending. And that's, you know, it's self-contained, and it's an old system because you can do it with fiat currency, you can do it with gold. That's, you know, the traditional way that governments finance themselves. And then model two is international government borrowing. So the United States also borrows from foreign creditors, such as Japan, China, European nations. And that's been a big part of our financing for the past 40, 50 years, especially with the world reserve currency. So, you know, back in the 80s, that was our foreign debt, like held by foreigners, was about 5% of our GDP. But now that's up to over 30% of GDP. Mm. So we've increasingly relied on borrowing from foreigners, which is mainly that we send them dollars through trade deficits, and then they recycle those dollars back into borrowing our treasury securities, which we then deploy back into our economy. And then the third option, which is when a government runs out of actual lenders, like either domestic or international, that's what we're seeing more today, where they employ quantitative easing. So the central bank essentially creates dollars and then uses those dollars to buy treasury securities. So you can think of the treasury and central bank as, you know, theoretically separate, but in that sense, they start working together. And then the fourth model is being more discussed, and that's an MMT model, which essentially takes that third model and more unifies the two between the treasury and the central bank, so that the central bank is more fully monetizing deficits and not really worrying about running large deficits. And that's kind of what we're seeing today.
That sounds kind of adventurous. I wonder how that's going to work out. I want to get to the massive borrowings that the U.S. is facing right now with all that's going on, even before the current coronavirus situation. It looked pretty ominous to me, but more so now. But I would like to, Lynn, I would like to go to this repo crisis issue that I mentioned back in September 2019 when it reared its ugly head. And this was indicating problems. I like to call it, or refer to it as kind of the canary in the coal mine, suggesting there were some issues, some real underlying issues that were in play that weren't really visible until we suddenly saw a 10% spike, I think very momentarily, in September 2019 in the repo market. Can you explain to us what the repo market is and what caused that spike in interest rates? What were the underlying causes for that?
Sure. The repo market is an overnight lending system between banks and financial institutions where they borrow in exchange for providing safe collateral, such as treasuries. Mm-hmm. And normally that's a very low rate. It's a very boring and liquid market. But in mid-September of 2019, that rate suddenly spiked to, as you said, about 10% overnight. And it, you know, was something like 2% before. So it just was a massive spike. I haven't seen one of those since 2008. And at the time, there were kind of two camps. One camp was the more mainstream camp, which was, oh, it's not a big deal. It's a technical issue. It's due to corporate seasonal tax payments. It'll resolve quickly. And then the other camp was, you know, worrying that there's a major bank collapse somewhere or some sort of party wasn't being trusted. My analysis generally kind of focused on the middle between those two extremes and showed that it was mainly a treasury oversupply problem. So since the end of 2014, when QE3 ended, U.S. banks, large banks, were filled with about 15% cash levels as a percentage of assets. And they also had about 15% of their assets in treasuries. And then primary dealers, one of their jobs is they have to bid at auction for treasuries. And then they generally resell those treasuries to the rest of the world and to other buyers. But starting after QE3 ended, the dollar became strong and foreigners were no longer really buying treasuries at the scale they had been. And so we kind of reverted to that first model of financing where the domestic economy was lending treasuries, like buying treasuries, lending to the federal government. And we actually saw banks become major financiers of the deficit. So over the past 5 years, they drew down their cash levels from 15% all the way down to 7%. And their treasury securities went up from 15% to over 21% of their assets. But the problem with that is right during the week of the repo crisis, they hit their lowest cash levels as a percentage of assets since the global financial crisis, which was about 7%. And so essentially, banks were being forced to buy at auction treasuries, but then unable to readily sell them, particularly T-bills on the secondary market. So they were getting their cash levels were getting crowded out by treasuries. And that's why even before this COVID-19 crisis, back in the autumn of 2019, the Federal Reserve had to come in and start printing dollars to just buy treasuries outright and to start monetizing government debt.
And so you had the specter of massive borrowings by the United States. I mean, Donald Trump has not been anything like a traditional Republican. He's been spending, some would say, like a drunken sailor, spending like crazy, has no limits. The foreigners then were not coming forward to buy treasuries. I know you're suggesting that there was a relationship there with a stronger dollar. When the dollar is stronger vis-a-vis other fiat currencies, the foreigners have tended to stay away, and then when it gets weak, they come in and buy. Do you think that's something we can count on in the future, that they'll be back, that the foreigners will be back if the dollar gets weak?
That's uncertain. It's possible that we've saturated our international lending base at this point. We've had three major dollar cycles since 1971. So the sample size is pretty small. We have a sample size of three. So it's hard to say what's going to happen on the fourth cycle. But over the past three cycles, that has what happened.
So it seems to me, I mean, Stephen Roach back in 2004, he was an economist with Morgan Stanley. I used to read him faithfully. I picked out something he wrote in 2004 the other day. I found in my files, and he was warning that the United States was living beyond its means. It was borrowing too much from foreigners, and it had to stop it. It had to stop its consumption and start financing itself. It seems to me that this is the underlying problem, though, isn't it? Lynn, that the United States has been living beyond its means for so long, and now comes along COVID-19, it seems almost impossible. I mean, how are we going to ever finance this enormous trillions upon trillions of dollars that are being spent now to try to keep the ship afloat? How is this going to work itself out?
Yeah, so in earlier decades, debt as a percentage of GDP was smaller. So whenever foreigners weren't buying as quickly, it was easy for domestic sources of buying to take over. But now that debt, even before the crisis, was over 100% of GDP and foreigners were not really buying, that left the Fed as the only real buyer of treasuries, which they do so by creating dollars. So we're, as far as I can see now, we're kind of in the phase where the Federal Reserve has to create dollars to buy treasury securities. Now that, you know, there could be months where they can get away with less of that and we can go back to actual buying. For the most part, with deficits this big, the Federal Reserve is going to be the primary buyer for probably quite a while.
And why then would we go from QE to MMT? What would be the advantage? Why would the powers that be do that?
Well, I'm not sure I'd call it an advantage, but it's more just like pointing out what people are discussing these days, which is essentially trying to find ways to get money to the public more readily than these previous mechanisms have. So, for example, if you look at QE from the Great Financial Crisis, most of that went into recapitalizing the banks. It didn't really get to the people.
Right.
Whereas now we're in a situation where the people are the ones that are under threat from this virus, so there are a lot of political efforts to try to get more money to them, and it's a different type of QE essentially than what we saw 12 years ago.
Akin to maybe helicopter money or something like that, you might say.
Essentially, yeah. I mean, the $1,200 checks that many Americans received earlier this year were an initial version of that, and so are extended unemployment benefits.
Well, in your article, you laid out your thinking about, you know, how this could play out. You mentioned John Exter's inverted pyramid in one of your articles that I referred to. I have a little bit of a contact to John Exter through a friend of mine who married his daughter. But so I've heard a lot about John Exter over the years. Really quite a remarkable man, for sure. But he was always a deflationist. In your article that we're talking about now, inflation or deflation, it's an ongoing discussion. You can certainly see the deflationary pressures mounting with massive unemployment and bankruptcies and everything else that's bound to start appearing here. But which way do you think it's going to work its way out? You talk about it in the article, and frankly, because we don't have enough time to do justice to your thoughts on this, really people should go to your website and read this article and other things that you write. But maybe just give us a summary with the 3 minutes we have left here, Lynn, to give us an idea of what your thought process is on how this might resolve itself. What will be the outcome of this seemingly disastrous situation we're in?
Sure. Yeah. Over the past four decades, we've had a very strong disinflationary trend. So we've had lower and lower levels of inflation, at least consumer price inflation, everyday goods. There's different ways to measure it. So there's different discussions on exactly how much inflation has changed. But generally, it's been a more deflationary trend. Mm-hmm. And that's, due to rising debt, it's due to aging demographics, a variety of reasons. But once you hit the zero bound, which we're at now, and you start kind of relying on just massive increases in the monetary supply, my analysis points to, we still are at near-term price pressure because especially in discretionary goods. So as essential goods, we're already seeing some inflation. But for discretionary goods like buying new cars or, buying other large discretionary purchases, this year we're probably looking at a pretty significant deflation. But going forward, inflation is definitely a far more likely outcome over the next several years, in my view.
Mm-hmm. And you also certainly pay a lot of attention to the precious metals as a way to protect yourself. Would you like to comment on that briefly?
Yeah. So in the current cycle, I started adding gold, silver, and gold stocks to my portfolio in about Q3 of 2018. And I continue to hold them as a pretty important segment of a portfolio.
Mm-hmm. And this is your personal portfolio. Your newsletter you provide, people can get a pretty good idea of what your thoughts are along these lines on an ongoing basis, right, if they sign up for it?
Yeah, I provide a model portfolio that I also put real money into just to kind of track it along with the readers.
Excellent. Well, I want to thank you so much. We should have you on again sometime, hopefully, to discuss in more detail some of the things that you write about, because I think that you really do provide a lot of great information that can be very helpful to people who aren't focused on the financial realm. So I just want to thank you so much, Lynn, for being with us, and hopefully we can do it again sometime.
Yep. Thanks again for having me.
You're welcome. All right, folks, well, we do have to go to break now, but don't go away, because when we get back, Axel Merck will be with us. He's the President and Chief Investment Officer of Merck Investments, and he's the manager of the Merck Funds. So Axel will certainly have some things to say about some of the same topics that we just talked to Lynn about. So don't go away. We'll be right back with Axel.
Great Bear Resources, trading under GBR on the TSX and GTBDF on the OTCQX, is a gold exploration company focused on their 23-kilometer flagship Dixie project in the prolific Red Lake Mining District of Ontario. Having recently made multiple high-grade gold discoveries, GBR is fully funded to complete a very active 200,000-meter drill program through to the year 2021. Stay up to date on what's been considered one of the best performing exploration stocks in the last 2 years by visiting greatbearresources.ca.
Voice America Business Network. Work. The bottom line in business.
You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really pleased to have Axel Merck with us once again. He is the President and Chief Investment Officer of Merck Investments, manager of Merck Funds, founder of the firm bearing his name, he is really an expert on macro trends as well as an innovator in gold and currency investing. And we've certainly had Axel on this show in the past. He's well known, frequently seen on Bloomberg and CNBC and all the main channels, the business channels. So it's really good to have you back again. Thanks for joining me, Axel.
Good to be with you.
We talked last week about some of your products, and you have a lot of other things that you're involved with that besides the bullion account. The bullion product, but you also ASA, Gold and Precious Metals Fund. It's been around for a long time, I believe. It is a closed-end fund that invests in gold and silver mining companies, I guess, primarily, right?
Yes, founded in 1958, yeah.
And I had in mind that it must have at one time owned a lot of the South African gold stocks.
That's right. That's right. That was kind of how it got started in the beginning. You couldn't invest in many of these things in the U.S., and so that's where it had its origin. Indeed, it was a South African company. It was incorporated in South Africa, and it is one of the few foreign entities to date that trades as a closed-end fund in the U.S., and it was reincorporated in Bermuda beginning of the last decade. And so it's a bit of an odd beast from that point of view, but we were awarded the management of that fund about a year ago in April last year, and we reshuffled the portfolio, changed quite a few things. I'm not around since 1958, just to make that clear, right?
Well, I know.
And there were some issues, notably on the cost side, and we gave this portfolio new life, so to speak, and it's a very different portfolio from how it was a year ago.
So I've noticed that it tends to sell under its net asset value, and fairly significantly so. Why is that the case?
Well, first of all, closed-end funds are not like ETFs that have a market. It does have a market maker, but since there is no creation and redemption, the last time the fund issued shares was in 1958, there is no arbitrage opportunity, so to speak, and so many of these funds traded a discount. ASA has traded a bigger discount than some. And one of the things that we have seen is when we outperform, the discount tends to get bigger. And we've tried to address that. Well, and similarly, in March, we were hit, as anybody else, by the downdraft, especially since we've shifted the portfolio to be more assertive, we call it, more downstream. We've been helping to finance many of the small mining companies. And so we got whacked pretty badly, so to speak. And so we're at the bottom, the discount was low. Now that we're recovering and hopefully outperforming again, the discount has gotten a little bit wider. And then we tried to address it through a bunch of things, including more communication. Also, we even have a Google ad campaign running to get new faces. Like the gold investor is an old investor, and I mentioned this once to Frank Holmes, who I'm sure has been a guest on your show.
Sure, yes.
And he says, well, the gold investor has always been old and will always be old. So let's say we want to get a new old investor then, so to speak, new faces to look at that. And then particularly the closed-end fund, we think it's a, by helping to finance many of these projects, we think that this very odd and archaic structure, so to speak, that's not so common anymore these days, has a purpose.
Mm-hmm. Well, so you actually, I mean, I'm looking at your portfolio, and I noticed quite a few names, some of which I cover in my own newsletter. So you definitely are down market, and so does the fund take private placements or get involved in buying off the market, or how does it do it? It gets into companies that are developing projects that you've, in your view, have great upside potential, or what? What's the philosophy?
So the mandate is to invest in precious metals companies, obviously, and we have reasonable flexibility on how to do that. And as I indicated, we've gone downstream, away from the royalties, away from the big names, more to the smaller ones, development companies, some exploration plays. Most of these are public, and what happens a lot with these small gold miners, because they're in notorious need of capital all the time, they buy a shell company, and so they have a Canadian listing. And so when you participate in one of these capital raises, they tend to be publicly traded. They sometimes issue warrants as well. There is a market, but not a very liquid market for some of these warrants. And so we don't do entirely private placements. We don't go that far downstream.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's certainly interesting, but it seems strange. Why would the difference between the NAV and the price get larger when you're outperformed?
Well, because the message has to sink through, right? I mean, for years, this fund has been rather dull, to phrase it politely. And so the message has to get through about what this portfolio is all about, that it is more dynamic, and that it is, and also, as you're aware, in the initial boost we've had in this segment, the seniors kind of had the first leg up, right? That's very common when you have a new bull market. And so the message has to get through that this is trickling through down there to these others. And so we are very confident and comfortable with the positioning. But with a closed-end fund, like with any other product, it's about communication, and that's our job. So we've had some webinars, we do other things, and then we try to be very clear about what we do, and then over time that may attract the right sort of investor.
Well, certainly if you're a value investor, you look at something that's selling at 12, 15, 20% below NAV, you would think that's something that would be attractive. So, I hear what you're saying.
No, the big guys, there's no guarantee that the discount is going to get smaller, but yes, you do get them at a discount.
Yeah. Well, anyway, it's a very interesting product that I hadn't really been aware that you were involved with. And as you say, you just really took over it fairly recently, within the last year or so, I guess, right?
That's right. In April last year, now it took us, we were involved for several months to help streamline many of the things. The fund used to be internally managed, and because of the bear market in gold, the cost structure was just got out of whack, and so we worked with the board to put various best practices in place. It's not that they did bad things, but to modernize many of the things. And with that, I think it's more of a traditional structure now. It's still a closed-end fund. It's still a Bermuda-based fund, and so from that point of view, it's a bit of an odd vehicle. And so anybody who looks at it, please do go to our website and look at the disclosures, because that does come with some quirks. But at the same time, hey, we do like it. So the short of it is, if you do buy it, you may want to hold it in a retirement account, because otherwise you have some other tax issues that come
some
with it.
Some other issues. Okay, good enough. Of course, everybody should talk to the tax accountant then, if that's the case. So, fair warnings there, I guess, and you're suggesting people go to the website. So is it ASA, if they just do a Google for ASA, or how do they find the website?
It's asalimited.com, asaltd.com, yes.
Okay, excellent. Well, I want to ask you, get some of your thoughts on the markets and the macroeconomic picture here. My goodness, it's certainly something different than we're used to, that's for sure. Recently on Bloomberg, I saw a clip you talked about inflation being one of the most underpriced risks. And that was on February 12th, before the coronavirus really reared its ugly head in a major way anyway, and shut everything down in the economy. And so, you know, at that time you noted that we were still having full employment. Well, I mean, employment has dropped off a cliff, as everybody's well aware of. Now that that's taken place, we just talked to our last guest, and she was suggesting that in the near term we could be looking at some real deflationary issues, though I think in the longer term she thinks inflation is a real risk. But what are your thoughts now? Because you made that statement, you know, February 12th, and I know very well things were humming along pretty nicely and at that point in time, but now we're not at full employment. So what are your thoughts about the outlook for inflation or deflation as we go forward?
Sure. Maybe you mentioned a bunch of topics. First, for context, the reason I had mentioned it is because we were pulling people from the sidelines in the labor force while we were at record low unemployment. And I said, at some point, we're going to kind of exhaust that pool of available labor. Now, we don't have that problem right now, except that Powell says, hey, this worked so great, last time around, I'm going to wait again before I tighten any policy, because you see we can go very low and this is not going to be an issue. And of course, we've had some changes. But to just look at the kind of assuming at some point we'll recover from this, the sort of policies that have been put in place or are contemplated to be put in place may well be much more inflationary than the past. So we didn't have inflation last time. Even Bernanke is hedging his bet about how we're going to come out of this one. And the reason is that when you give, say, a corporate tax cut, as we had recently, well, that's inflationary in an indirect manner, right? It boosts the economy, boosts employment, and so forth. But when you do infrastructure spending or direct cash handouts to people who actually need the money, right? I mean, if the wealthy get wealthier, that doesn't mean they spend a lot more money. But if you give people who are desperate for cash more cash, they will spend it. And and so the sort of stimulus we are seeing and will see is more inflationary. And then just about talk about this inflationary environment right now, well, yes and no. I agree with that in principle, but I think we touched on it last week. When you have the CPI come out, now I know plenty of people have issues with the CPI in general, but for last month, we know it was wrong. The CPI is supposed to measure the average consumption basket. And while nobody is average, we all know that nobody drove a car last month. And so the weighting of gasoline is completely out of whack. And then conversely, of course, what everybody did use is go to the grocery stores, and that those prices went up. And so we had inflation last month, despite what the official numbers say. Overall, of course, yes, with all these efforts to keep everybody in business, which I guess there's a good reason to, we will overproduce many things, right? I mean, let's look at the automotive market. Anybody who lost a job is going to return the leased car. We're going to have an abundance of used cars. So why should, that's going to put a lid on price pressures in cars. But inflation isn't something that comes uniformly. It pops up in different places, and suddenly it pops up in more and more places. And so I think that's where we see a real risk at the tail end of all of this.
Yeah, it would seem so. Helicopter money. I mean, it's the propensity to consume is at least one of the Keynesian ideas that makes a lot of sense to me. That when you put the money in the hands of people who are poor, and they need to put food on their table, and they need to pay their rents, that they will do that. And if you give the money to a rich person, they'll probably put it in their bank account or buy a stock or whatever. And we've seen, I would argue, tremendous amounts of inflation, but in the financial assets since 2008, before that, too. You would agree with that, I guess, right?
Oh, yeah, sure.
You know, if the rich get richer, the people that don't have to spend all their income on just simply living costs and can afford to buy some things. Hopefully, a lot of people in this listen to this show have enough to buy some gold and some assets and are doing okay. But that propensity to consume. So we're going to your friend out there, Nancy Pelosi. She's from your district, I believe, probably, or right around San Francisco there somewhere. Well, she's suggesting that everybody should have what, $3,000 a month, or $10,000, or everybody should get $100,000 a month checks, or what? I mean, so I would think at some point we'd start to see hyperinflation.
If you think about it, well, the money doesn't get you anywhere. That's the problem, right? If you spend, the last I heard was $2,000, maybe we're $3,000 now, but at $2,000 a month or at all, if you spend, people need a job. They don't need a handout, right?
Right.
And so if you spend $2,000 a person to have that person work safely, I think we could open up this economy in no time, right? And by the way, they do that in much of the rest of the world, and they don't spend $2,000 a person. So I'm not suggesting we shouldn't take precautions as we open up and whatnot, but paying people to stay at home is hugely expensive and is causing a lot of damage, because as money doesn't quite grow on trees, last time I checked. And so it's a waste of money. It just increases our debt. And sure, for the time being, the markets are benign about it. But fear not, our policymakers are able to mess this up in any which way, right? And so we'll just see what they cook up next.
Yeah, we'll see how they mess things up next is the way you can put that. Axel, you have quite a bit of experience in the currency markets, and what is your view of the dollar now?
Well, the dollar had been a beneficiary for numerous reasons of late because of the panic trade. There was, because a lot of people borrow dollars abroad, they scramble to reduce the leverage, and just like in the short squeeze, there was a flight into the dollar. If I look at the markets right now, the LIBOR market, the interbank borrowing market has all but normalized in the meantime. And so, and as we speak today, the dollar is weakening. I think that's one part of the trend. The next part is that an election is coming up. Right now, the odds are that whatever constellation we'll have, as you've just pointed out, will be spending a boatload of money. So that may be inflationary. When combined with a Fed that's not going to take assertive actions against it, that may weaken the dollar. And then on a purchasing power basis, our analysis shows the dollar is about 20% overvalued. And so that's a downward trend. Now, that doesn't mean the dollar is going to go down every day. Indeed, just because it's expensive doesn't mean it can't get more expensive. But in my analysis, it favors a weaker dollar. And intriguingly and interestingly, obviously gold appreciated versus the dollar. But other than that, the dollar had appreciated versus just about all currencies in recent months.
What about the dollar's role as the world's reserve currency? I want to run an idea past you and see what your response is. This is from Alistair McLeod, who is a frequent guest on this show. He argues that if the dollar rates go negative, and I don't know if you think that's a possibility, do you believe that the U.S., that the Fed will push into negative territory with the treasuries?
If you asked me some of these questions years ago, I would have said never on earth, right? And now it's a little different. Now the little dip in the Fed funds futures market we saw recently, I think that's more a numbers game, because what happens usually with the market, let's say the Fed says, hey, rates are going to stay at 2%. And the market then believes they're not going to go higher, but they always have to price in the opportunity of a shock. And so the futures market tend to trade a little bit lower. And now the Fed funds futures are at 5 basis points, 0.05%. And so for a while, not today, but for a while, they priced in just slightly negative rates, for next year. And then obviously Powell said it's not going to happen. And then right now it doesn't. So I don't think it makes any sense. I don't think the Fed is going there, but I'm never going to say never, because in this world, a lot of taboos have been broken.
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, a lot of things. I mean, 2008 seemed extreme, but now maybe we're looking at something even more extreme for sure. But here's the idea that Alistair McLeod has run by on this show, and it makes sense to me. He suggests that negative rates for the world's reserve currency is a bigger deal than, let's say, for the yen or the euro even. And that's because of a concept of time preference, which I think you probably agree with. The idea that, whatever I own has some time preference to it. Having it today is worth more than waiting a year or two or sometime into the future. And so Alistair argues that if the U.S. dollar goes negative, if rates go negative, why would anybody want to own the dollar when you can go out and buy gold and maybe get 1% or 2% on it, or at least you don't lose value of it on it, holding it, or silver or copper or whatever else. So his suggestion is that if the U.S. dollar as the world's reserve currency goes negative, and since everything in the world, all these commodities are priced in dollars, who would hold the dollar any longer? I don't know what your thoughts are of that.
Well, first of all, with regard to gold, gold doesn't have much of a correlation to most things. The one thing we do see a correlation with is real rates, notably on a 10-year uh-huh. basis. And indeed, Japan actually has the highest real rates right now in the major countries here.
Just interesting.
To show you how absurd this world is, right? So the nominal rate obviously is a factor in that. Now, you could have made similar, I think there's a risk of that, but you could have made similar arguments about the euro and other currencies. And we invest around the globe in currencies. And by mandate, we kind of have to hold something, right? And if you're the treasury department of a large corporation, you've got to hold something. As an individual, you can stuff it under the mattress. But a big S&P 500 company or a big British company or whatever, they got to do something, and they're not in the gambling business, and so they will, up to a degree, hold it even if it's negative yielding. The bigger issue I see in the U.S. is that you have a money market fund industry where people are used to stable net asset value, and that's very difficult to sustain when you have negative rates. And so it will break fundamental pillars of the U.S. financial system. Not that it means everything will break down, but there's a lot of damage that will be caused with negative rates in the U.S. You don't have those issues in the rest of the world as much because many of these markets are not as developed.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot to think about there. I guess just with 30 seconds left, so what should people be doing right now?
Well, they should follow their process. I mean, in this sort of environment, it is easy to the glasses are full one day and half empty the next day. Have a plan and stick to it. Only revise it if you think that you're really wrong, but not because you hear somebody else, including myself, say something else today or tomorrow.
Yeah. Well, there's one thing that we're pretty sure of is that over the long run, gold is money and it holds its value, and fiat currency, contrary to that, loses value. That's pretty predictable. Aren't both of those statements pretty predictable? Paper money will decline in purchasing power,
of course,
and gold will not.
If you have expenses tomorrow, the price of gold is volatile, right? So if you have a major expense tomorrow, there's a good reason to hold cash. Now, I happen to like gold, but I mean, you've seen how much gold has moved of late, right? And in the short term, it can do anything. I like it. Historically speaking, gold has always done well. You never quite know why you hold it for tomorrow. I happen to like it, yes.
Right. You hold it for tomorrow for insurance, for sure. All right. Well, thank you, Axel. Yeah. Thank you so much for being with us. We're out of time. We'll look to do it again sometime in the near future, if you're willing. And so, folks, that is all for this week. Next week, Richard Mayberry is with me, along with Michael Oliver and Dr. Quentin Henning. Until then, goodbye and God's blessings to you.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.
Auron Resources is an exploration company defined by its aggressive ambition to find the world's largest mines. Auron has raised over $100 million in this effort and believes it is on to three major discoveries at its projects in Canada and Peru. This year, Auron plans to drill Sombrero, where targets have analogous features to the 10th largest copper mine globally. The company also plans to drill its other substantial base and precious metal opportunities that management believes will be complemented by the strongest bull market in commodities over the last 50 years. Visit AURYNResources.com and subscribe to keep up with the busy year ahead.